Hello, thank you for joining us for what should be a great game.
The fourth official couldn't allow him on because the fourth official never had a sheep.
Well, he overheated up the baby, did he? Unless he's breastfeeding, he should be all right.
This is the Football Family, the 42's dedicated football podcast. I am David Sned, and firstly, thank you to Gavin Cooney for taking the reins in my absence last week. If only all substitutions were so smooth and positive. The sage of Portlaoise, Shane Keegan, has licked his wounds after Arsenal's North London derby win to at least keep the Premier League title race going into May. It's early stages in the League of Ireland still, but Shells ended a five-game winless run to comfortably see off St. Pat's on Friday. Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool reign is limping to a sour conclusion. No laughing, please. But Anfield has not yet been set ablaze as Salah keeps his counsel after that confrontation on the touchline. But to kick things off, let's start with a little bit of Springer Spaniel chat with Damien Duff.
Yeah, she's great.
What is she?
She's a Springer Spaniel from Glasgow. I guess a couple of amazing things that I brought back from Glasgow. I got a crammed football education in 2 years. I brought home a couple of league medals, a couple of cup medals, and on a par with all that is Bella. I was always afraid of dogs. I would run away, but here probably sometimes the best thing is to go get a dog, and she's me best mate. From Glasgow, yeah. And she's a soft Glaswegian. She doesn't like the wind, the rain, the snow. She just likes cuddles and being pet. So we go run up the mountains up around Greystones, Delgany. Yeah. I meet Tony O'Donoghue there. He does be running, doesn't be running. He does be walking his dog. I'll see him about once a month.
Yeah.
But now I'd like to go running around the hills with Bella.
Right, lads. Nice bit of audio there. Duff is a dog man. Only recently. I'll hold my hands up. I'm still afraid of dogs. I have to be honest. I am terrified.
I'm not surprised that Duff is a dog man because he's a discerning man of taste. I thought he'd have a bigger dog than a Springer Spaniel. I remember once going to a talk given by Conan O'Brien, you know, the talk show host and Simpsons writer and general good vibes man. And it was at the Philosophical Society in college, and he tried to explain what his philosophy. I know, drop that in there. But he tried to explain what his philosophy was, and he came up with two ideas. One was wait until the iPhone 9 because that'll be the best one. They actually skipped the iPhone 9, and his second philosophy was like, if you're gonna have a dog, it has to be big enough to knock you down.
That's
so I thought Duff would be a similar. Duff's a hard man, you know. He's old school hard man. I thought he'd have a, if he was gonna have a dog, it'd be enough to knock a man down.
If A. Dervin was to that shell, I would have made a joke about a Springer Spaniel, but he's not.
I am not a dog man, despite the fact that we actually have a dog in the house. But I just don't bother him, and he just doesn't bother me. That's kind of the mutual agreement that the two of us have. He gets lavished with love from my wife and my son, and it's his dog. It's their dog, really, not mine. But I wouldn't be able to understand where Damien is coming there with the love for the dog. It's just not something that's ever hit me, I'm afraid. I know that makes me a lesser man, but it is reality.
It barely makes you a man at all. I can't believe what I'm listening to.
No, not. I don't have a massive dislike for them. Like, we just kind of have enough going on in my life to have to worry about a dog. You know, that kind of way.
That's the last thing he needs. The last thing Shane needs is another job.
especially one from which he can't claim expenses.
But I'll be honest, I am very, I'm sceptical of dogs. I'm not going to lie, but the only pets I've ever had, and even when I moved into my house that I shared it with my two children and my wife, I got goldfish and called them York and Cole because I was being very original. They did not last a month. I just wasn't very good. But the reason why I threw in that dog chat at the start is because the clip that did go viral with Damien Duff over the weekend was him bringing the supporter from the Riverside stand in to give the post-game team talk. The gist of which, and Duff even said this to us because there wasn't much sense, was basically, let's fucking go. That was basically the gist. Which, and by all accounts, Mark Coyle seemed to kind of follow that trend from the supporter. But I was very interested. I just couldn't get over the reaction. And typical, obviously, it's obviously from fans of other clubs just saying how, you know, this is Duff. He's performative. He's a load of shy. what's he doing? It's all an act. He's only doing it because he kind of tore up Shane Farrell the week before, and he's maybe trying to get fans back on side. But Gav and Shane, I'll come to you on this second, Shane, because obviously you are a coach and a manager. Like, I just don't see how you could not be Damien Duff and act like Damien Duff if it was an act, because it'd just be far too tiring. It's all consuming as it is, just being in his own head, as he continually says, where he's always talking about he needs to have a purpose, he needs to have something. Like, people need to just get over the fact that what Duff is doing is not an act. This is him.
I agree. I have to say, I absolutely loved it. I can understand why Shells fans absolutely loved it, and a fan of every other club in the country is mocking it. But I think there's a part of them deep down that would like if their manager was Damien Duff and he was doing stuff like this for them. I wasn't sure when I watched the clip whether Duff had just thought of this spontaneously. He just happened to catch this fan's eye and whipped him out. But no, it was pre-planned. And I wonder, was it pre-planned down to the very fan he picked? I mean, had he this face in the crowd picked out ahead of time? I'm not sure. Did he just take whoever was conveniently down near the front of the stand? Have I ever seen it before? I don't really think I have. But it's great. I'm all for this stuff.
Yeah, no, I definitely haven't seen it where a fan has been plucked to do the post-match huddle almost. That's a relatively new thing, even with teams doing it. Even that in itself, because Shells have started doing it, that in itself before would, Shane, be used as a way of mocking a group of players or a manager when after each game they get together for the huddle. Now, bear in mind, I don't think they've had a chance to do it for 5 games because they hadn't won in 5 games, so you can understand why. But it is something that I copped early on, and everyone did at the start of the season, that this is what Duff was doing, getting the players together after every win and celebrating with the fans and having that sense of togetherness.
Yeah, like Gav says, I definitely can't think of a time I've seen it before. Is it somewhat a version of, wasn't it Mourinho got one of the ground staff to give a team talk or a half-time team talk? Or
Arteta did it, didn't he? Arteta did it last year. Was it the documentary? When was the documentary? Yeah. You remember he got the kit man, who was a big Arsenal fan, to do the team talk before the North London Derby or something?
Yeah, I remember something like that going on. But yeah, on your broader point of, is it performative from Damien Duff? Like, so yes, as a manager, right, you have to be yourself. Now, there's times where you have to be somebody else because management is situational and you have to be able to deal with different situations as they arise in the manner that they need to be dealt with at that time. And what I'd say is, I would find, speaking from my own experience, I would find that maybe 80 to 90% of situations I'm able to deal with as me. And then maybe there are, you know, the odd occasion every here and there where your natural self isn't 100% at home in that setting, and therefore you need to go and almost pretend to be somebody else to deal with that particular situation. If that doesn't sound too mad. The only thing here is, for me, that was probably the case of flying off the handle. I'm probably a little bit too calm and a little bit too zen. I don't know if I ever actually flown off the handle. Yet I have within the dressing room on 2 or 3 occasions because I made myself fly off the handle, if that makes sense. I went in and, you know, went mad and roared and shouted and all that kind of thing. But it probably wasn't actually heat at the moment. It was, again, that was a little bit performative because it was what that situation absolutely needed. And as I say, even though it wouldn't come naturally to me, I realised it was what that situation needed. The thing with Duffer is, I think you can flip that the other way around. I think Duffer been mad is his natural state. And I think the moments where Duffer has to be a bit calmer and more reasoned are the ones where he has to adjust himself almost, if that makes sense.
I'm quite relieved here on behalf of your unloved dog to hear that you're not naturally inclined to fly off the handle at all, that you are so placid. And just sorry, one other quick clarification. Shane, you're mixing it up when you talk about Mourinho and the Arsenal ground staff. It was actually Mourinho brought in Gunnarsaurus to do his tactics.
Arteta brought in to do Gunnarsaurus, I assume.
Nah, it was Mourinho. It was Mourinho's dinosaur.
Mourinho
using dinosaur tactics.
David, can you edit that so I don't seem thick?
I'm not gonna lie to you, I didn't get that straight. I actually googled that as you were saying. I was like,
Okay, maybe that has to go.
David, if me and you had gone to philosophical societies, we might understand these kind of jokes a little bit.
Listen, Shane, some of us don't still have our Trinity College's email addresses. Do you know what I mean? I actually got in touch with Ballyfermot College of Further Education to see if they could actually reactivate mine. But I was told, Lincoln College, just to fuck off across the road to Chasers and get what you're doing. But in fairness, in this section of the podcast that is sponsored by the RSPCA, I think we all are talking pony.
Well done.
And by the way, I should lob it in there that as a young fella, Gav, I did actually have a dog and his name was Klinsman.
Klinsman? Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Who did you name that after, Shane?
I wonder, Gav.
I was just thinking, it's also kind of rare to see post-match huddles, I think. I don't know how often you do see them, and I'm thinking of other famous instances. And I do think that Brendan Rodgers could have preempted Damien Duff here. You know, the famous post-match huddle that Gerrard gave after Liverpool beat Man City.
We will not let it slip.
This is where I'm gonna
get Sean to just stitch in. We do not let this fucking slip.
Only, obviously, to then. Like, I mean, what incredible baiting of fate, and only for him then to slip. So what Brendan Rodgers needed to do when he saw Gerrard rallying the troops there is get someone out off the cop just to say that, lads, you only need 7 points from your last three games. It's not that desperate a situation.
Should be remembered that Shells did win the game. It was probably one of the most comfortable 1-0 wins I've seen. And fairness, John Daly kind of fronted that up afterwards, where he even was acknowledged that. Where he was put them at one point where they were saying, oh, you had a couple of chances. And he straight away was like, yeah, but Shells had three or four. Like, we can't be saying, like, there was no, he was straight up, didn't deserve to get out of the game. And I'm not gonna lie, one of the benefits of working for a website, you're not working to a deadline, so I didn't mind the fact that he kept the players in the dressing room until for a good bit longer after. And I just asked about this after, and it kind of was a few minutes. So here's John Daly, because obviously Pats are going through a bit of a tough time at the moment, talking about Friday's result, but also kind of the kind of pressure he's feeling at the moment as well.
Kept the players in the dressing room for a bit longer afterwards. Was that kind of maybe just the nature of what happened in the performance? I think the angriest you've maybe been after a game?
Probably, yeah. I think, I thought we were very good up in Derry and we get beat. And then, you know, I thought we were poor tonight and we get beat. So it's like, we need to find a way to start winning. Whether we're playing well or we're not playing well, we need to find a way to start winning. And it's you know, you probably have to sometimes let the players know that you're frustrated and you're not happy, and that's part of the game, isn't it?
Is it a challenge for you as well, John? Because last season you came in, you took the club up at the bootlaces, led them to the cup final win, and you know it's been a rising tide. Mm-hmm. Is this your sort of first sort of challenge yourself, your manager, when you see where the recent results have been?
Well, I think that's obvious. I think, you know, we've kind of had a steady climb, as you say, and then this is the first kind of real challenges that we've had in terms of, you know, results, and the first kind of time that we've, you know, had to, you know, dig in and try and try and find a way. And I think, you know, at the moment we're not doing that, and we need to quickly work that out. And it's obviously a challenge, and it's a challenge that I'm more than prepared to, knuckle down and roll up the sleeves and make sure we get ourselves back on the horse and go again.
Because it's a collective thing. It's not, you know, you expect more from the players, but you also probably expect as much, if not more, from yourself as well. It is a collective thing, isn't it?
Of course it's collective, but I don't think, I wouldn't say I'm working any less harder because we were successful last year. I'm probably working more harder because, you know, the expectation levels have been risen, you know, so you're, you know, they're not getting any less detail than they were last year. So, but you're right, it is a collective. It's not just the players on the park. It's not just the boys that are on the pitch. It's everybody. It's the ones that are coming on, you know, come on and make an impact. I don't think, look at the subs tonight, I don't think anyone that came on changed the game in our favour. It is a collective. It's not just about the players, it's not just about the boys not performing, it's about everybody, it's all the staff, it's everybody. So the boys are working hard in training, we're working hard in our preparation, so it's just trying to as I said, you get that little bit of luck, gives you a bit of a little win, and then you get a bit of confidence and you just go from there. So it's just at the minute we're just in a little rut at the moment that we are trying to get out of, and I'm sure you know, we'll do that.
You were saying about kind of finding a way of winning games, but like you mentioned, that the first 25 minutes, half an hour was good, but then Chelsea had a few minutes of pressure, and that's when the goal came. It's also important just not to concede in those moments as well.
100%, yeah. I think it's, you know, same up in Derry. It's like it's scoring when you're on top. In this league, first goal, we know, everyone knows it's so important to get that first goal, and it's when you have a little bit of dominance in the game, you need to try and make it count. And you know, Dave, obviously, as you said, they had a little bit of pressure, and then they got the goal off the back of that, and then that gave them that confidence to kick on. And we felt at half time that we could cause them issues in the second half, but I didn't think we'd done enough in the second half. We didn't exploit the spaces we spoke about, and you know, that's probably the most disappointing thing.
And was it mostly you talking in the dressing room after, or is it one of them where players actually have to say as well in terms of what's happening?
There was a few conversations, but yeah, mostly probably me. You know, I'm a passionate guy, I probably don't show it an awful lot, but yeah, look, it's what was said, and we'll move on and hopefully get a reaction from it.
So basically, just continuing that team then of managers, Shane, this is an interesting one in the sense that obviously John Daly came in at Pats last year when he was the assistant, probably wasn't, and went in as caretaker after Tim Clancy parted company with Pats. I don't think he would have got the job unless he had such a kind of positive impact at the club, where he got some good results. Then he gets the job, season goes really well, qualify for Europe. Not really in a title challenge, but we're there and thereabouts for the last month, and then obviously win the cup. Bit of an overhaul over the winter, players come in, and now at this point, like, they are still struggling. Like, you can hear the frustration in his voice there. This is going to be a big test for him now at this point as well.
Yeah, and look, it's your stereotypical difficult second album, really, isn't it? Not that it's a foregone conclusion that the new manager will always get a bit of a lift, but the real questions are, once you ride out that initial period of the new fella and he's doing things differently than the old fella, and we didn't like the old fella, so we like what the new fella is doing. Once you come through that period where they stop thinking that you're a great guy just because you're not the last guy, that's where the real test kicks in. That, for me, is where the real test kicks in. And that's the period he's in now. It's probably the first time in his managerial career, obviously, because it is his first gig, I'm pretty sure. So, like, it's his first time to find himself in this situation where people are now going to be looking at him and he's going to be talking and they're going to be thinking, not sure about this guy and not sure if I fully buy what he's saying here. But the managers who have careers... not that they don't have that period, they all have that period. The point is, they all manage to come through that period. They all reinforce when those question marks arise within their players. They come through that and they do get the results and they do swing things back around in their favour. And that's what he's got to do now. Simple as that. And again, look, I know in general, when we talk about the division in general, you have to remember, like, it's... I think we've said it last week, like, two wins and everything is sunshine and rosy, and you know you're going to finish it, qualify for Europe. Two losses and your fan base are calling for you to get the bullet. Like, that's genuinely where it's at the moment for about half a dozen clubs. Two have made changes already. I think you're going to see a lot more changes over the course of the year, I think, to be honest with you, the way things are in that division. And look, it won't take a whole lot for him to correct things and get things moving back in the right direction again.
Well, you say there about the two games, probably the perfect week to sum it up, because obviously Friday Pats have Drogheda, and then on Monday they're away to Sligo. Like, two wins there, and depending on how your two other games go, as you say, like, they could be in the top three.
That's it, and look, it is worth pointing out that two games without a win, and holy shit, now he's definitely starting to feel the pressure. So they are two absolutely massive games for him. Like, it's kind of... You know, it's hard for him to be in the middle ground after those. He's kind of, you know, I would argue he's still in the middle ground at the moment. They're not doing as well as they should be doing, but it's also not absolutely awful. Far from it. I don't think he's anywhere... He shouldn't be anywhere close to his job being seriously called into question. And yet... And yet I'm saying he's probably only two games away from that potentially being the case, because... you know, two wins, everything's rosy. Two defeats or 1 point from two, and now he's definitely in trouble.
Obviously, it's been another, like, Pats keep having these off seasons where they win the cup and there's just no momentum to carry through. Obviously, Stephen O'Donnell left after the last cup, and obviously too much rancor, and you know, maybe some things Pats couldn't control there. But you like, again, massive amount of turnover in this off season, and okay, they were always going to lose the likes of Sam Curtis, but you know, other guys like Mark Doyle, I think, is a bit of an underrated loss there. And I have to say, I thought they'd struggle in the early weeks of the season. I thought they'd be beginning to get their act together by now. I mean, David, you were obviously at this. Like, I mean, so you kind of saw it in far more detail than either of us did. Like, where is it going wrong? Like,
Well, do you know what it was? First half an hour, they're a better team. Didn't really penetrate in the final third. Had a couple of moments where you got into good positions, where I'm thinking it was a couple of crossing opportunities and final kind of, you could see passes in the final third that possibly could have been made that weren't, and little things like that they could have easily have taken the lead in that first half an hour. Then Shells weren't at it at all. Shells were really poor in that first half an hour. Like, Duff was gone ballistic on the sideline. Like, they weren't, and no energy about them. They weren't kind of closing down space at a certain time. Pats were able to play out relatively easily. But then as soon as Shells did maybe just get a bit of control, and they had a 3-4 minute period, that's all it was, kind of referenced it in my match report, where they got on top and then they scored. They cut Pats open. And in fairness, John Martin took his goal very well. Like, it was actually a very well worked goal in terms of first time finish, and how he got the, I can't remember this, I think it could have been Keely, he got the run on. You're probably thinking maybe the centre half is caught too side on, maybe too square. He should have maybe read that run across him. And then after that, there was no reaction at all. Like, not even in terms of, like, it wasn't as if Shells then, even in early in the second half, dominated the game in terms of with that kind of aggressiveness and kind of so much that you would kind of associate with him in power. Pats just seemed real laboured, you know. And maybe, I don't know what the reason was, maybe it was just a lack of confidence coming off the back of that dirty game. But I don't know, it was just maybe, we're kind of trying to go through, but the first goal, it's clear the first goal is just so important. I go back to the Rovers game a few weeks ago when Rovers took the lead, and on another day against Pats, they could have been 3-0 up in the first half an hour, but Pats managed to stay in the game. And then Pats, when they did get on top, took their chances very well against Rovers, and that seemed to be a moment where you're thinking they might just kick on. And kind of just like what John Daly kind of said there in that audio we played earlier, just knowing how to kind of, when you're on top, just get that moment, be ruthless and get the goal, because that first goal, Shane, no matter what, is so important, especially when you're lacking in confidence, any team. I know we're talking there about managers and what the influence they can have in terms of, like, who they are and, like, how they kind of address people and just how they are, but, like, you just need to get that first goal. Like, you need to just get a win somehow to kind of breed that little bit of confidence. And that's where you said it there. Like, Drogheda coming and then Sligo, two teams that are below Pats. Just got to double check here now where we're actually chatting, but two teams who are below Pats but could very easily be above Pats in a week's time. Do you know?
Yeah, 100%. And look, in terms of what you said there, like, if you'd said before the game, yeah, getting the first goal is all important, but also, what are you able to do once you get your head in front? So, like, if you told me before the game, one of these two sides is going to win the game 1-0, well, you know, I'd be fairly leaning towards Shells as being the one that would have won the game 1-0 if we knew that was going to be the scoreline, because they just seem to have that in them, don't they? That, you know, they get one up and then they love dealing with the pressure of trying to keep that clean sheet to see out the win, and that's the kind of steel that's there at the moment that maybe isn't quite there with Pats. But, like, the table at the moment, the way things are going at the moment, you just look like a fool, because you make proclamations on a team and 2 weeks later the take you had was absolute nonsense. And, you know, I would just be overly wary of anybody coming in too hard on Pats or in too hard on Daly at the moment, because I just think it can be rectified so quickly. Now, while at the same time giving myself the get out card of he could be gone in a week's time if he lost both games this weekend, you know, it's pretty mental.
But even on that, so you look at, so, like, tonight Rovers have drawn at home, because obviously that's the game that had been postponed because of the weather a few weeks ago. Like, Rovers going into this, they should, let's be honest, well, in fairness, Drogheda have done well, reasonably well at Antalya, and produced some good moments at Antalya over the last couple of seasons. But Rovers, you would expect, will win that game in hand and should go second, and they'll be 2 points behind Shells. But I don't know, like, it's just, it's like what you're saying there, like, at the moment, like, Rovers have won fewer games than Bowls, you know, Rovers have won five, Bowls have won six, it just seems like a very strange season. Like, I know Derry had that good win away at Waterford, but then, and then obviously on the back of that, then, well, before that, they beat Pats, but I don't know, like, I know Sheldon had a blip, but I just don't. This season seems very, very strange. I don't know what it is. I just don't get a sense that will be a huge, massive points thing that's going to actually win this. I think there's going to be loads of little trip-ups for everyone.
Well, there's always a deceptive number of games played in the first couple of months of the season. Like, I mean, I think Rovers, through kind of those European game, those teams involving the sides in Europe being brought forward and postponed games, I think they're going Friday, Monday, 3 weeks in a row or something. And it's not a great time to be playing so many games if you're Shamrock Rovers, because their injury list currently reads Sean Hoare, Lee Grace, Neil Ferrugia, Jack Byrne, Gary O'Neill, Marcus Pumar, McInniff, Graham Burke, Richie Towle. Like, that's near, like, you could argue that's nearly their full starting team. You know, so it's a pretty unfortunate aligning of circumstances. Stephen Bradley very unimpressed by those who were fit and playing for Rovers in that 1-1 draw against Galway on Friday. Saying something along the lines of that there's some people basically taking it a bit easy. The implication being that, well, there's injured players now, so there's no one going to take my place. But, you know, that's evidently a rocket up them. I still think they only need some of those guys back from injury and they will kick on. I'm just waiting for that kick that we know that they have. But also an amazing stat from extra time. I didn't realise this. That 1-1 draw for Galway against Shamrock Rovers ends a run of 21 straight defeats against Shamrock Rovers.
Really?
It's the first time they've avoided defeat since a 1-1 draw in 2009. I mean, fuck me.
Since 2000 and what? 9?
2009, yeah. That tally was open then, was it?
Yeah, it would have been, yeah. Shane, what's your record as Galway manager against Rovers?
I can definitely remember one particular game where I felt I was after getting ridden rock solid I very clearly remember a very, very contentious goal, which ironically I think was actually scored by Lee Grace at the back post. They bet us every time they played against us. But I'm not as surprised by Gavin's stat for the simple fact that I was told when I was there in whatever it was, 17, 18, that it had been like 9 years or whatever since they hadn't been beaten by Rovers. So it obviously continued on for a few more encounters after that. It's a ridiculous record.
I know we're not living in the dark old ages of before, when after Friday night's games you had to wait until Monday to actually see them. But just for those who are listening and don't know the results in the weekend or from Friday's games, so obviously the other games, Bowles actually getting beaten 2-0 by Dundalk. I'm not going to lie, even with the new manager bounce, I did not see that coming. And obviously you mentioned there that Derry beat Waterford and Galway and Rovers drew 1-0. But then obviously Drogheda beating Sligo. And at the moment, it's looking like one of the Loud teams is going to be getting relegated. Well, I made a joke, actually. This is not going to translate well, but it's coming to my head straight away. And it's been on my mind for the last couple of days. So Scott Hoy scored for Dundalk the other night. Straight away, I turned to somebody in the press box to talk and said, "Hey, what about it? The High King of Dundalk."
And were you immediately contacted by the Sun newspaper as their new headline writer?
Well, actually, that's the reason why I said it, is because Owen Cowser was my colleague to my left, who I thought straight away would give me, kind of like lift me up on his arms and like basically told me to fuck off and stop talking shit. I thought that was a good one. But is Kinger going to, like, by all accounts, he didn't have a kind of a, he was kind of taking a bit of a back seat, was he?
Yeah, I think so. I think he said basically that he felt he hadn't been in long enough to really call the shots, so he was happy enough to leave Gartz, do the majority of it by all accounts. You're probably right, I would think, about the Loud clubs. The only thing I'll say is I was in the RSC Friday night, and Jesus, now look, you're not going to judge a team by how they perform against Derry, because it is, look, Waterford's season isn't going to be defined by how they do against the top half teams. It's going to be defined by how they do against the bottom half sides, but they struggled. They really struggled now Friday night, to be honest. And then to come off the field and see that the two teams below them had both won their games, it's definitely going to start to cause a few jitters around the RSC, I would think, you know.
What was it they were kind of struggling with? Obviously, they lost the game, but if you're looking, thinking, don't like the look of this, what was it?
Sure, every element of the performance bar a 15-minute period probably, and I suppose the killer for them was during that 15-minute period that Derry actually got their second. I say Dundalk because there was so many fucking Dundalk, ex-Dundalk players on the pitch, I think. I would have always classed Keith's teams as trying to play football. You know, that Watford team we came up against last year played some absolutely lovely football against us. Under Keith and Trevor played fantastic football. Jesus, this could not have been any more route one if you tried. And the only success they actually got was when they reverted to 4-4-2 with about a half an hour left and just continued to play in the manner they were. But now lumping it long made a bit more sense because they had brought on Evans, is that his name? Big 6'4" centre forward, went in alongside Pod Jammond. And they actually started to trouble. They actually started to trouble Derry a little bit during that period. But by and large, they had little to no possession of the ball. They didn't really cause any goal scoring chances. Park Hammond hit the woodwork from one set piece, and defensively, like, I know Patrick Hooban will, you know, we are talking about one of the best nines around, and he is a physically dominating player, but I mean, it was ridiculous how much he bullied the Watford centre-halves. Like, it was like absolute men against kids stuff. Like, he just physically, absolutely dominated the two of them and pushed them around, and it was just, they were at their ease. Like, it was when the second goal was going to come, not if. They missed two sitters at the start of the second half. Like, this could have been a lot more comprehensive than, and look, 2-0 is reasonably comprehensive as is, but it could have been a lot worse.
Last High King of Ireland, by the way, was trained in Dundalk. Who was it? Cool.
Go on.
But prior to Scott, I suppose.
I'm gonna have a guess. I'm gonna guess. Chris Shields.
No, Chris Shields actually just missed out. It's actually slightly before Chris Shields' time. It was Edward Bruce, crowned in 1316. I don't know.
Fabulous, Steve.
I was going to say that's how Alex Bruce qualifies for Ireland.
Now, fairness, though, Mark Hannell's listening to this and he's thinking, Steve Bruce has a link now, I'll go back.
On Dundalk, I'm not making any more predictions around Dundalk. I mean, prediction is a fool's game, etc. Ramp it up to 11 when you're trying to predict anything around Dundalk. I mean, we've spent years predicting what's going to happen at Dundalk, and I don't think any of us have been right.
No, I'm just agreement. Haven't been stuck in the middle of it for a while. I'm just agreeing with Gav, basically. That's all.
I was going to say, how are you finding now mentally, Shane, after coming out? Are you back in the safe place now? Do you feel good?
Out of Dundalk or football in general? Which are we referring to there?
I'll let you take the lead on that. I'll let you.
You are looking at the Dundalk thing, and you're like, I know we've kind of said it before, but there's a book to be written there, isn't there? My God, how it's like Rovers. I'd say Rovers can't believe their luck. Like, no matter how much Rovers got their act in order, they were still going to be reliant on Dundalk somehow managing to rip to shreds everything they had built, and Jesus, they managed to do that in double quick time.
Remember when Rovers signed Roland Fein from Dundalk, and people are like, what is he doing, why is he going there? Like, it's going to be like, just shows you
he was in the know.
Possibly. So moving, I think a nice little segue in to just to have a little bit of chat about the fall from grace of Roberto De Zerbi, and we're continuing the managerial trends. I said this months ago, probably last season, said undoubtedly a great coach, but great managers slightly different, and when the shit hits the fan, what happens? I'm only being slightly cheeky there by Shane, because I'm just trying to wind Shane up.
Yeah. It starts spraying Roberto De Zerbi in the face. Can you believe it's gone so wrong?
It is disappointing. It is disappointing, definitely. It wouldn't make me doubt him a huge amount. I still think he is a fantastic manager. He's not getting him chewing over his side at the moment. Are they that far out of kilter with where they should be? Are we looking at a team and a manager who's a victim of their own success? I wouldn't think they should be. I wouldn't think their budget is much higher than 12th in the Premier Division, surely.
Yeah. And I was only being a bit of a messer, because when you think about the players that he lost over the last window. Like, it's always going to be a case where you're not going to always be able to replace him. No matter how good your kind of model is, or how good your kind of recruitment is, it's always going to be difficult to continually kind of keep that flow, especially at that level of quality up. And also, they weren't in Europe. They've had injuries, isn't it? Mitoma has been out. I think was Pascal Gros out for a while and just seems to be out of form.
Yeah, Sally March and Mitoma.
Yeah,
the two white players who are so important to how they play. They're big losses. And obviously, McAllister and Caicedo, we can see how good they are individually. So imagine taking them out of a team. Like, I mean, you're ripping the heart out of a team.
There is a lot of mitigating factors there. The only thing is, he seemed to be able to ride all that out early on in the season. And I do think that he and the club in general are a little bit of a victim of their own successes. I say, if you were to draw up the table, they're probably about par for the course. So they are. But I suppose his reputation was built on, his reputation early in the season was based on the fact that he was far more than par for the course. It's disappointing, because it is nice to see a fella who is so, so brave, or stupid. It's probably called stupid when they're not winning games and brave when they are winning games.
How come Liverpool didn't go for him, do you reckon? Like, or maybe, listen, we don't know the ins and outs. Maybe they did and they just didn't, or they don't like what they see. But I know, obviously, Arnie Slot, it hasn't been confirmed, but it seems pretty much nailed on that he is going to get the job now. Like, it's all being pretty much agreed. But, like, why? I'm surprised, like, surely someone, like, considering, like, how he is raved about him by other coaches and all, and then that personality that he has, I would have thought, Jamie, he's absolutely tailor-made for Liverpool in terms of, like, I don't know if you saw it, Gav, I was watching Stick to Football, I think it was Stick to Football, and Carragher was talking about this, and it's a good point into the whole kind of scout psyche in terms of they want that manager who they feel is one of them, and it's going to stand up and basically be that big personality. And that's probably why, as much as that, and that's why Klopp emotionally has been such a good success there. But it seems strange, maybe, that someone who has actually delivered so well in the Premier League, got a team into Europe, and seems to have kind of had such an impact, maybe didn't seem to even be kind of discussed.
Came out fairly early, I think, was it David Ornstein of The Athletic who reported that he said De Zerbi very unlikely to be in the picture for the job. I think it speaks for a slightly wider thing that I kind of find it a little bit weird about this kind of search for a successor to Klopp. Obviously, Alonso is the ideal pick and then he ruled himself out, but, you know, there's still loads of kind of top quality managers available or attainable at the very least on the market that Liverpool have ignored in pursuing Slot. Like, Tuchel has not been mentioned regarding the job at all. I mean, okay, he has issues and maybe he's a difficult personality, but, you know, to list off the managers in the last 5 years who've competed at the level Klopp has, you've got Arteta, maybe Hansi Flick, and then you've got definitely Guardiola, Ancelotti and Thomas Tuchel. So the fact that he's on the market and seemingly wasn't looked at in great depth surprises me. Would Nagelsmann have renewed with Germany if he thought the Liverpool job was on the table? I really don't think so, just because the club game is where it's at. Just feels to me that they're recruiting, that the manager that they're looking for, they're looking to hire the kind of candidate that they would have hired before Klopp was there, when they were, like, you know, a kind of 5th, 6th, 7th place team in the Premier League. Not exactly a big club, but without the kind of guaranteed firewall of a super club that Klopp turned them into. And I think maybe they just want, I think you might have hit on the right thing there, David, with personality. I think De Zerbi and Tuchel and these guys, even maybe Nagelsmann to a point, they might be difficult to get onto and have their own ideas, much like Klopp did. And it seems like Liverpool feel that the way that they get ahead is by indulging Michael Edwards' transfer genius, you know? So maybe Slot is a bit of a yes man. Slot might be hired on a very literal sense as something into which Michael Edwards can slot his giant brain. But I still think it's a risk. Yeah, I really think it is a risk.
For some reason, I just did not think you were going to say brain.
Oh, sorry. that's some poor imagery if you're listening to this podcast any time before 10 p.m. To circle back to my initial point, they obviously reckon that they can get ahead of the game by giving Edwards the keys to the kingdom with Richard Hughes, the new sporting director. I don't know, I feel like maybe Slot will work out, but I thought, like, all the guys you listed, De Zerbi, Tuchel, Nagelsmann, all these guys would surely be on anyone else's shortlist for a job of that size, but Liverpool obviously want to do it differently.
The other theory that I have with the Zerbi is clearly he just wants to stay and make sure that he's has an attack of Evan Ferguson and Mark Mahoney.
Mark Canham, give him a call.
Mark ringing Mark O'Mahony or ringing the Zerbi. I say that about Evan Ferguson. Obviously, he's recovered from injury. It looks like he's going to be ready for pre-season, so he'll miss those Ireland's friendlies in June. They haven't got a manager, so it doesn't really make a difference. But it's like, the quote here from the Zerbi, I think he, this is obviously O'Mahony, can be the new Evan Ferguson because he seems a lot like Evan. Maybe Evan has a different shot, but Mark is better in terms of possession. He understands the play better. We will see. I want to give them the chance to play for sure. Well, I saw that quote first on social media, and I didn't think it was one of those that was in like a, it was done up, and I was like, I don't know if that's actually going to be real. And then I saw it was actually a legitimate quote from the Zerbi. Now, it's promising that he's speaking that way about O'Mahony, and even from my own just quick kind of sussing out about him, it does seem to be the case that, like, a lot of stuff we will say about Mark O'Mahony in the next few minutes is exactly what we were talking about with Evan Ferguson. It's someone who, by all accounts, has jumped the queue since he's arrived from Cork in Brighton because he's just switched on. Like, he's able to be coached. They put him on various programmes in terms of tactics, nutrition, strength and conditioning, obviously football in general, and just took to it straight away, no issues, and has just been on an upward trajectory to this point. You'll talk about people in the background in terms of his parents, and obviously they're delighted with him. But then people will say at Brighton as well that obviously they're a club who will give youngsters a chance, maybe when others might not see that they're ready. And O'Mahony obviously fits into that mold that they say, well, no, we'll take a chance. Partly injuries could be part of the reason for that. Maybe Ferguson was there and he mightn't have. But it does seem to be a case that, like, he's got an opportunity. His profile now is going to be rising, and he's going to be dealing with a lot of stuff maybe similar to what Evan Ferguson dealt with 12 months ago, Shane.
Yeah, well, Evan isn't going to be 20 this year. We do need a new Evan already. He's clearly past his...
He's not even a teenager.
Past his... This has to be record time for being past yourself by date, has it? A record time for being the next of Ferguson. But no, look, it's... Look, I think I spoke about it here before. I watched an awful, awful lot of Mark in 2022 as an underage player with Cork City. He was kind of in and out of the team. Well, not even in and out of squads with Cork City's first team, even though he was only a young fella at the time. But it was fairly clear that he was going to have to bide his time. And I just thought... I thought he was absolutely as good as I'd seen at that age. Absolutely fantastic. The similarities for me between himself and a young Wayne Rooney, I just thought, so like the carbon copy of him in terms of how he goes about things. So yeah, I'll be honest with you. January of last year, late December, early January of last year, it was looking really, really good that we might have been able to get Mark over to Cove Ramblers. I was talking to Stephen Ireland on a fairly regular basis. Stephen was in agreement that if he stayed at Cork City, it looked as though he would continue to probably only see limited time. Whereas I was saying that I could, based on what I'd seen, you're not going to guarantee any man starts, but based on what I'd seen, I could all but guarantee him to be a first choice starter week in, week out for us. And I thought it'd be a brilliant way for him to cut his teeth and he could still live at home. And we even spoke about the fact that he could still maybe train with Cork City, you know, one or two mornings a week if they were willing to loan him to us, and then train with us one or two evenings a week and all of that kind of thing. But all of these conversations were around the caveat that Stephen had him over on a couple of trials in England at that time, and if any of the clubs that he was on trial with said yes, well then obviously that is the direction he would be looking to move in. So unfortunately for me, that is how it played out. Look, don't get me wrong, when I say that, I thought he looked a class act. Did I think he'd be, you know, starting in the Premier League by, you know, less than 18 months later? No, I couldn't have predicted that. But so, like you've outlined there, what he's done since he's landed over there just must be ticking every single box for them in there, you know?
How was he able to go over? If he's under, was he 18? He obviously must have turned 18 when he went, was it? Because I think he was 18 in that January, or was he?
Yeah, that could be right, is it?
Yeah, no, I was just double checking there. Yeah, no, I see it was, yeah. But it's that. But even with that, Shane, and like, I know obviously again we're joking, but like obviously Evan Ferguson's kind of gone through a bit of a rough patch. He kind of said so himself in terms of when he obviously with the injury, and he's laid up now for maybe a month or so, possibly a bit longer. But it just speaks to, like, I know there's, when you're all, like at any academy I suppose, but even in the UK, and how it was put, was you're always getting chased. There's always someone chasing you. Like, you get to that first team, and even when you're in that first team, it's just, it's incessant. Like, it's relentless. There is no, that's where I'm like you can understand, and this isn't saying it about Evan Ferguson, but just in general, like, maybe lads get a couple of good contracts, and you can kind of, even speaking from my own point of view, I just don't see how you could not maybe just drop off a little bit, where you feel as if, right, I must have made it now. If they're giving you that contract, if you're in that four-team squad, not that you have to keep on improving, but like, O'Matney's coming in at the point where, as it was put, like, he saw people that, not even in the first team, who were above him in, say, a couple of different age groups at Brighton, and has just leapfrogged them.
Yeah, and I think your broader point makes sense, definitely, in terms of how players could lose hunger at a very young age. I think it is very important that we do clarify here that we're not particularly talking about Evan Ferguson here. I would be fairly sure that that Evan isn't counting his chickens, or we're unlikely to see a drop off in motivation levels from Evan, I would imagine. But like, it is, yeah, like you say, the idea of the next, you know, you're only just coming through as the next big thing, and the next thing you're being usurped by the next big thing, is, you know, it's very, very, very dog eat dog. Look, in an ideal world, wouldn't we absolutely love to think that De Zerbi can re-find his touch, get Brighton back playing in the manner that they were in the first half of the season, and that at some point in 2024, we see a front two of Marco Matney and Evan Ferguson. That is the dream stuff. But there's the small there's the small problem of all of the other ridiculous amount of options that he has there. I mean, I think João Pedro is, I think some people don't realise just how good he is. I mean, you know, we're talking about certainly a few months ago, and I still think is the case, we'd be talking about a world-class talent in Evan Ferguson. But I think even more so in João Pedro's case, he's even more so, you know, proven, and obviously he's that bit further developed. So when people are saying, you know, how come Evan can't nail down a team in that Brighton, a guaranteed position in that Brighton team? Well, hold on, that's like, he's up against an absolutely sensational player.
But he also hasn't been fit. Like, clearly, like, this is an injury that I think De Zerbi has now admitted that they tried to play Ferguson through this ankle injury for a while before. I'm glad that he's made the decision, or the club have made the decision for him, to allow him to shut down for the summer and recuperate. And obviously, you know, he shouldn't be involved in the Ireland friendlies at all in June. But like, for how long have they been playing him not fully fit? I know there's a whole thing, like, you know, you get to a certain age as a professional and you're never fully fit. Like, I think Gabriel Jesus was talking about that lately, that there's no game in which he plays entirely pain-free. But like, Ferguson is only in his teens. I can't believe, all I know about Brighton, I can't believe that they were playing him through injury, especially with relatively little to play for. You know, maybe they decided when the Europa League is over, maybe we'll give Big Ev a bit of a rest. But the Europa League's been over for a while now. I'm really shocked to hear, like, the extent to which it seems he's forced to play on through. And it would also explain his performances for Ireland in March, to be honest. He plays a lone furrow up front for Ireland at times, does Ferguson. But you could see how much sharper Ida was when he came on. There's not that much of a gap between them as players, talent-wise. So either it was fatigue or either it was injury. It seems maybe it was injury. And it also seems that Ferguson was overplayed by Ireland in those two completely pointless games against Belgium and Switzerland as well. So I'm glad he's getting a rest. He should reflect on a season that probably breakthrough season, really. First part of it was absolutely insane what he did. Was it kind of a record number of Premier League goals for a teenager in a calendar year? Obviously hasn't scored since that Nottingham Forest game in November, but for how long has he been suffering these injuries? We might never fully know, but hopefully he'll come back fully fit and sharp into next season. And trust me, I don't think it's anything to worry about.
From one player-manager relationship that's not quite on the rocks, but it's clearly a bit strained, to another that will soon come to an end. A quite bitter, sour end. You mentioned Jurgen Klopp earlier, Gav. Him and Mo Salah. Mm. That was an interesting quote all the same. At the start, I didn't think too much of it, where it was like,
you know, obviously Salah having a bit of a, obviously a bit of a tour. But then this quote after where he says, if we speak, what was it? If we speak, there's going to be a fire or something like that.
There will be fire.
There will be fire. Like, fair play to him, I must say. You know, like, in fairness, if you're not going to stop and speak in a mix zone, fair play for at least giving that line.
Mo Salah is saying in a mix zone that I can't speak, there will be fire, is the most he's spoken in a mix zone potentially since he joined Liverpool. He never stops. I think maybe there's an agreement that he would do it when they won the Champions League or something. He never talks to media there. Bizarre. Kind of a very grim and sad end for Klopp now, I have to say. Liverpool falling away. Liverpool weren't good enough to win the title. Ultimately, I think that's fairly fair. If you analyse the whole season, I think them being third is decent finish for them. I think they're probably the third best squad. City and Arsenal are just well ahead of them. It's kind of galling for them that they had the league title in their hands at the start of April and they've fallen apart. But if you kind of zoom out and kind of look at all the stats and blah, 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 and just kind of weight them up against City and Arsenal, it's kind of Liverpool really reverting to the mean. This is how good they are. They'll play to just about par or slightly above it. It's a cruel and unusual way to revert to the mean by missing all these chances. But I did see a stat on Twitter before the recent game against West Ham that Liverpool's XG across the whole season in Europe and in league games and in the domestic cups, I think their XG was 89.1 and they scored 89 actual goals. So they've actually, you know, they're obviously missing chances, like they're going out of fashion at the moment, but maybe they were freakishly accurate earlier on in the season. So I think, yeah, look, they've got some qualities in the team. They've got some big Darwin Nunez-shaped weaknesses in the team. I think it's pretty obvious. A couple of other weaknesses as well. No fairy tale end for Klopp. And you just be like, come on, lads, can we not just get along for the last few weeks, you know? But obviously Salah feels differently.
It's interesting, though. I think I've said this about four times, so it's interesting. But it's amazing how the kind of whole perception of a season and a state of a whole club can change based on say, the results. If you go back to... And this isn't me just saying this because obviously people listening to this, if regularly, will know that obviously, yeah, I support Manchester United, fair enough. But if you go back to the Carabao Cup win, and people were saying, oh, the difference between what Klopp is doing, and it was put obviously about Ferguson, when Ferguson left, that it was an old team, needed to be totally ripped up. Now, bear in mind, it was an old team that won the league, but that's a different topic. But, and they were talking about all these young lads coming through at Liverpool, and the future is bright. And then all of a sudden, if you actually look at the business end of this season, like, maybe other than Kwanzaa, and now obviously Bradley's been injured, none of them have got a sniff in the league. None of them have got a sniff, or even really in the Europa League. Do you know what I mean? And then you look then at the actual team that Liverpool have got. Salah looks as if he's going to be gone. You would think he's probably got one more year where he can make it, try and get a transfer fee for him. You mentioned a weakness in Darwin Nunez. Even Jamie Carragher seems to have lost patience with him after the Merseyside derby. Like, that miss, my God, against Everton, that is actually incredible.
Yeah,
it's incredible.
That's all he does. He just blasts it straight. The first guy will hear of the verb to slot is when his new manager walks.
but if you look at then the rest of it, even with say Alexander Arnold needs to get signed to a new contract. Van Dijk is the other side of 40. Konate looks to have fallen off a cliff in the last few months. Szoboszlai, is he still playing for Liverpool? Wasn't too sure what the it's amazing just how the season has kind of petered out, and then all of a sudden from a point, and it'd be hard to argue in February time when they did win the League Cup, similar to United last season actually. Everton looked very positive. This is something building, and then all of a sudden the nature of the season, all of a sudden you've said it there. It's like they've got a manager coming in. And it's like the mentality is, this is a manager coming in for a side who's going to be sixth or seventh and slowly building again.
Talk about kicking a club under down.
No, well,
you really enjoyed that one though, didn't you?
No, but no, it's amazing how, like, if you had it said to me even with United going back to February of last year when they won the Carabao Cup, I was thinking, you can see what's happening, the building for the future, blah blah blah. But then all of a sudden, the Irish can fall out of it a little bit. Do you know what I mean? And you wonder, is it almost a good thing? I mean, this is going to sound ridiculous. Is it almost a good thing that the Irish has fallen out of Liverpool so badly under Klopp this year for the new manager coming in, where it's not going to be this huge romanticised thing of, oh, we've lost the best manager ever, 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 even though he's done amazing things. People can actually be starting with the new manager thinking, well, do you know what? A change was needed. For partly because Klopp himself decided it was because he wasn't going to be able to, but just purely because of how the season ended. Arnie Slot will be coming in, and it's not going to be like, oh my God, we've just won the league, or we've just won the FA Cup and done so well in the league and everything was going so well. Like, the fact that it has collapsed so much could actually maybe benefit the new manager.
I have no doubt that Arnie Slot will have been sitting at home hoping the arse falls out of it. 100%. Like, seriously. Like, 100%. I agree with your overall point there. Like, does he want to be walking into a team which has somehow managed to hang on in there and fallen over the line? Imagine if they won the title, like, despite all the...
It would have been horrible. It would have been fucking horrible.
And then he just has to... He's arriving into where the general consensus is, well, look, you just need to keep doing what the previous guy was doing, even though everybody realistically has to know that there was massive issues there. At least now the issues are far more clear for everybody to see. I think most non-Liverpool fans could see what the issues were anyway. I think probably, to be fair, a good few Liverpool fans could see what the issues were as well. But I do think they've been magnified big time in the last couple of weeks, which is definitely a good thing for the new manager. No doubt about it.
I do think, very brief point, I do think Slot has to stop fucking about with Alexander Arnold now. Like, I mean, it's completely pointless what's happening now. Is that, especially against deep lying defences, we saw it this week, Everton and West Ham. Alexander Arnold kind of drops off to a kind of a quarterback position and trying to ping a long ball over the top into space that's not there. And on the rare occasion in which there is space, Diaz or Nunez are always offside. So, like, I don't know, they're kind of taking him out of. It's been so bizarre to watch. Like, they don't attack down the wings really anymore at all. Everything is through the centre, and they've just taken Alexander-Arnold completely out of dangerous situations. I don't know why Alexander-Arnold wants to do it. Maybe he's becoming like Steven Gerrard and just addicted to this idea of playing in central midfield. You can start him in central midfield, but probably further forward, or else sitting alongside someone, or else just play him as a right back. And playing, you saw the positions that Conor Bradley used to get into before he got injured. Alexander Arnold would be more dangerous in those positions. But sorry, that's a very minute point in the overall scheme of things.
Well, to go from one minute point to one very brief conclusion to this podcast. Obviously, Liverpool now are out of the title race. Arsenal have kept it alive, the Premier League title race. Arsenal have kept it alive. Just about scraping over the line in the end against Spurs. It was a very interesting game, just because interesting is the word that I've been using for the whole of this pod. I am going to say that Arsenal will win the league.
I don't agree.
No,
I think
don't.
I think
Arsenal will win all their games. Sorry, Gab. I think Arsenal will win the remainder of their games, and I think City will drop. I think City will draw somewhere. Yeah. And just, I don't know why. I just think if Arsenal were going to lose the league, they would have lost it by not winning at the weekend. And I know it's still in City's hands, and City will probably win their games, all their games 5-0, because they're more than capable. And Haaland, maybe now could be, he got his goal against Forest at the weekend, and probably will score about 15 goals between now and the end of the season. But I just think now Arsenal will win the league, probably on goal difference.
I absolutely fucking dread the thought of it, and I'll tell you what, if it's because we take points off City, I swear to fucking God.
Well, you've got the situation where Spurs play City. That's their, I think, yeah. That's City's game in hand, isn't it? And then United have Arsenal at home, where you've got both the majority of both opposing fans thinking, do you know what? I'll take it here. I don't mind. Just take the L.
Like this, I was watching it with my young lad. It was just doubly horrible because, like, the only way we could go and put in, and the only way I could cheer for Tottenham against City was if Tottenham took points off Arsenal. Like, because Arsenal have beaten Spurs, the default now is that I now literally have to cheer for City against Spurs. I think it's just been made a little bit easier. I know this is a strange way of looking at things, but I think it's just been made a little bit easier by Villa getting another good result. So I'm kind of looking at him going, well, even if we bet City, we're still not going to get fucking Champions League anyway. Villa seem to be that far ahead of us, so let's just roll over now and play dead and let them tonk the shite out of us.
Top of the league after 10 games, were Spurs, and now they look likely to miss out in the Champions League. I mean,
And joining in on the kicking a club while they're down.
I just
for the day.
I want to put it to you, Shane, that Ange Postecoglou is not all that.
No, I disagree.
Doesn't bother with corners. It seems to have sat corners off. They're an indulgence for other people. It's not how we play, mate.
Doesn't even defend them.
No, I'm sticking with the same De Zerbi line here of, if you actually look at the quality of the side, you could argue that he's still fucking overachieved, even if we finish fifth. I mean, like, who... Ah, Gav, look at our centre midfielders wouldn't get a start for any other top 10 side.
Sorry, not the centre midfielders he picked. I don't know why Højbjerg played. But Bissouma is absolute quality.
He's shite.
Sarr... Get out of town.
Ask a Tottenham fan at the moment for their opinion on Bissouma. I'm telling you. He seems to have garnered this reputation. He was very good early in the season over those first 10 games. Since then, he has been awful.
What's Maddison mean like? He was getting a bit of grief. He had a bad injury, didn't he?
Horrendous. He's horrendous against Arsenal. So bad.
It's actually hard to put your finger on why he has gone as poorly as he has I'll be amazed if he starts next week. He's just about clinging on to his starting position. I'm speaking here as a doubly injured man who brought him in about a month ago into his fantasy football team, and he's been fucking horrendous. He's just gone complete. And I love James Maddison as a player, always have. He was one of the players I absolutely wanted to go out and sign, and I sincerely hope he will return back to the player that he is. I can't see any reason why he's not capable of it, but his current run vein of form is atrocious.
So you're not Ange out yet anyway?
Absolutely not. No. Get a proper midfield in there and we might have some hope of a proper assault on the Champions League spot next year.
Bentancur and Sarr, like, these are real good players. Like, you're giving them a complete pass here.
They're not. I've been saying it since the start of the season. I felt at times some of them have played above their level, all right. At the start of the season, would you have said Sarr would be a player good enough to be playing regularly in midfield for a Champions League challenge inside?
I think if you go back and look at my group by group preview for the 2022 World Cup, my Senegalese player to watch was Pape Sarr.
I remember you asking me about him at the time, actually.
So I think I was amazed by what they did early on in the season, but man, there are some recurring flaws there. And I also am beginning to wonder, geez, they had so many hits in the transfer market, but Timo Werner, you signing him? Have you lost the magic?
Yeah, no, that was another one that didn't make any sense, so it didn't. But look, at the same time, like, the point I'm making here again is based on at the start of the season, Tottenham were sixth in the betting. We finished one above where we're supposed to finish. Like, that's the reality. No matter how the season went, in terms, anytime your season has a good first half and a bad second half, you kind of suffer for, you know, whereas if it had gone the other way around, if he'd had a poor first half and a great second half, we'd be happy enough with finishing fifth.
And it's going to be the ultimate insult, Shane, when you end up beating City as a consolation in the Arsenal League.
No, I swear, I just couldn't deal with it. What I do think would be hilarious is my brother-in-law and his kids are absolute Arsenal fanatics. I think me and my young lad are going to go and watch the match in their house, because I just think it'd be hilarious watching them having to shout for Spurs.
I'm just glad we made it to this podcast without having to discuss Manchester United. It was bad enough having to go through St. Patrick's for a few minutes. So, folks, until then, take care.